All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech, coming to you from the quarantine studios at home here on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. You can follow us, as always, on Twitter at FDRLST and write us at radio@thefederalist.com. I'm joined today by Joel Kotkin. He is a presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in California and executive director of the Urban Reform Institute based in Houston, Texas. His next upcoming book is The Rise of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. It's out in May. You can follow him on Twitter at Joel Kotkin. Joel, thanks so much for taking the time to join us again.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to talk to you about a number of interesting pieces that you've been putting out in the recent weeks. I follow your writing at New Geography, where you will link many of the pieces that you've had at Fortune and Tablet, at Quillette, and at the Orange County Register. You've been writing about the trends in urban life and the issues related to density and to populated cities over the years. This is something that I feel like is going to be a major change that is resulting from the reaction people are having to this virus currently. How do you write about this in a way that understands the behavior of people both now in the midst of the current crisis and anticipates the different adjustments that we're going to see when things perhaps get a little bit more back to normal?
Well, I think there are going to be several big impacts. The first thing is going to be that if the virus works the way it looks like it's working, and which would follow, by the way, the historical patterns pretty clearly, you would have more and more people will really begin to think, well, do I really want to live in a dense urban place where I'm touching lots of stuff? I'm riding the subways. I mean, one thing we're finding very clearly is there seems to be a very strong correlation with transit ridership. That's why we have some of the suburbs around New York City have surprisingly high levels of infection. The other place where we see just very high, if you look at New York City, it's interesting. The increases in New York City and the big incidences are not Manhattan, certainly not the fashionable parts of Manhattan. It's really the if you take the 7 train coming from Manhattan into northern Queens, which is also the big concentration, one of working class people who really have no choice but to take the subway, or at the same time, it's the biggest concentration of Chinese population. I mean, look, I am very happy to live in a county that is 20% Asian and has many, many Chinese. I have many Chinese friends. Mm-hmm. I go to Chinese restaurants. I cook Chinese food myself. But there is a correlation, at least in the initial stages. So I think that what we're going to see is people are not necessarily going to ignore or go away from places that are ethnically diverse, but I think they're going to look for safety. Now, one of the things that we found that was really interesting is that, and I was talking to someone from the Irvine Company about this the other day, in contrast to Flushing or Sunset Park in New York, and obviously to parts of China, the Chinese community in Orange County has not shown any huge incidence of serious cases. And they ascribe that to the fact that most of the people the Chinese people who live here in Orange County, like everyone else, drives everywhere and lives in a house. And so that the potential for spread is much less. So what we're really seeing is people are going to have to start rethinking how they live. Now that doesn't mean cities are going to go away. There's always going to be a market for it. There are many things cities can do, which we can get into later. But one of the key elements, I think, that's going to have a huge effect on people is the fact that there's clearly a relationship with transit ridership and density and this pandemic. And this has happened historically. If you look at the experiences of the Spanish flu, if you look at SARS, MERS, these have tended to be concentrated in very dense cities. And I think that's going to have a big effect. I'm particularly interested in what the social memory will be of the young generation coming up. The students that I have now that I'm going to teach later today on Zoom. What the impact's going to be on that? And then lastly, the movement out of the dense big cities had already started about 2-3 years ago. And I think that will also accelerate. Again, I think cities are not going to go away. I think they're going to play an important role. But the future of urbanism is going to have to look very different than what we've had.
You write in your piece titled The End of New York, which ran in Tablet, pandemics naturally thrive most in big cities where people live cheek by jowl and are regularly exposed to people from other regions and countries. You use the example of the bubonic plague coming to Europe on ships from the Orient. Being away from people, driving around in your own car, and having neighbors you know all have clear advantages when it comes to avoiding and surviving contagion. Even the urban cognoscenti have figured this out. Like their Renaissance predecessors during typhus and bubonic plague outbreaks, contemporary wealthy New Yorkers are retreating to their country homes where they struggle with the local townies over occasional short supplies of essentials. Joel, as the children say, I feel seen by that comment. The fact is that we were in New York until a couple of weeks ago. My wife is pregnant and so high risk. But I had this day where I had to go to the pharmacy twice because they botched a prescription pickup and I needed to go back. And I just counted the number of people I had to be within 6 feet of just to go from the apartment door to the elevator, down the elevator, out the door, to the pharmacy and back. And I stopped counting after it was more than 40.
Right.
You know, in Virginia, I can walk to the pharmacy and back and never interact with anybody except for the pharmacist. And it's just is a major difference in the way people live. I think it's an eye-opener to a lot of people. My question is, to your point about the way that cities are going to change, how is it possible for a place like New York to change and adapt to something like this? A place like Houston, you're spread out. You have to drive to virtually everything. Yes, it's very populous, but it doesn't have the natural kind of condensed transit that you're talking about that's been so essential to the way of New York life.
Well, I think it's going to be a challenge. We're sometimes adversaries, but we're also friends. Richard Florida and I have been talking about what sort of agenda will cities have to adopt. And I think there are some interesting parallels. After the Spanish flu is when we started getting what I would call, and you know what I like, which is what you call sewer socialism. It was very clear that the kinds of outbreaks that New York was getting, not just Spanish flu, cholera, I mean, you read the accounts of early 20th century New York, and it really is, you know, sort of like, you know, what you would imagine would be happening in Calcutta. If you go to how my grandparents lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, these things happened all the time. Now, what cities need to do is to adopt what I call sewer socialism. Which is a term that was coined early in the 20th century. And basically is that the government, there are many things the government needs to do. I mean, there's no question that the government was ill-prepared. I think it would have been ill-prepared under President Obama. I think it was ill-prepared under President Trump. Mm-hmm. I think many cities and states were ill-prepared. I mean, part of the problem in New York is the hospital system. And my father was a doctor in a New York City hospital, and my mother was an emergency room nurse in a New York City hospital. These systems have been deteriorating for decades. They have less capacity than they once had. I think these are things that government should really be addressing. Obviously, they're going to have to begin to think about, in the case of New York and other big cities, of how to make dispersion work. In other words, maybe you might start thinking about, can we begin to provide more employment opportunities in the suburbs of New York, some of the outer boroughs, so people don't have to take transit into the city. Mm-hmm. There are lots of other reasons for doing that. Obviously, there needs to be cleanliness. And then, and I'll speak specifically about my adopted state of California, where I've lived for a long time. We have to do something with the homeless camps. The homeless encampments are such a threat, not just for this disease, but for things like typhus and cholera. And some doctors even predict that bubonic plague could come back. What's interesting is, and I speak as a, you know, I consider myself an old social democrat, both old and a social democrat, not a conservative. I've never ascribed to that, basically. But I think the key thing is that the old social democrats, you take a Harry Truman, a Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayors of Milwaukee, they believed the government had a role, but they also believed in personal responsibility. They would have never allowed homeless camps to fester in the middle of cities. I mean, if you go to downtown Los Angeles or San Francisco, it's all over the place. Well, that can't possibly be good for pandemics. So I think that we really need a really strong government, but a government that is less concerned about gender, race, and sort of the cultural extremism, and focused on actually making life better for middle and working class families, which is what the cities have abandoned. I think that if they abandon them the way they have, what you'll end up with is a bunch of 20-somethings who think they're immortal. Of course, they're not. And of course, the very rich who, you know, when bad things happen, they go stay at their house in the Hamptons. But what about the poor schmuck who's living in a studio apartment in Manhattan? Yeah. I mean, I'm amazed how people even keep their sanity.
Yeah. One thing that I'm curious about is you've been writing about this in recent years, and I've read, you know, so much of your work on this, that these trend lines that indicate that we have all of this population growth that's happening away from the cities, that's happening in the suburbs and the exurbs, that large urban centers have been steadily losing population, not just New York, but other cities as well. And so I guess my question is, how much of this is going to be a world of change, do you expect? And how much is it just going to be a rapid acceleration of a process that was already beginning in terms of people recognizing that they no longer want to put up with the downsides of living in a lot of these cities, and that they would prefer to have a life that is a little bit further removed?
Well, I think that you've said it exactly right. I mean, the reason these things are important is because they are building on what has already been happening. That's really the critical thing to think about. You have a situation where many, many people have already begun to think. I mean, there are several things. One, the big millennial generation is getting into their 30s. They're starting to have children. Now, in some cases, they won't have their first child till 35, 40, but that's going to change things. The second thing is that the tremendous amount of speculation, real estate speculation that went into the cities, created a huge amount of studio and one-bedroom apartments that were extremely expensive. So that did not really create a urban alternative for families. You know, if you go to the old days, I mean, when I remember when I was growing up as a kid in New York, you know, it was not unusual that middle-class people had three-bedroom apartments on the west side of Manhattan, where you could conceivably raise a family. That's gone. Then you add to this the fact that urban politics, as the middle class has left the cities, have become more and more insane. I mean, can you imagine that we're going to have criminals let out of prisons? We're going to allow for homeless camps. We're going to allow people to defecate on the streets and think that that's not going to make life worse and that that's not going to lose middle-class families. That's kind of crazy. And, of course, you now have increasingly a socialist, anti-business environment in cities. You know, no surprise that Bezos is moving a lot of his jobs out of Seattle and into Bellevue, Washington, which is a close-in suburb. So there are lots of forces that were already taking place. I was already pretty clear for about 2-3 years that this process was growing. The other thing that they're doing, and you mentioned this, if I move from working at McKesson in San Francisco, in the right on Market Street, I mean, I remember because I lived in the Bay Area, and you know, I know where they were, and I moved to North Dallas. My life is far more affordable. I have space. I'm going to probably be able to live in a good school district, and of course, I drive to work. So in a pandemic, if I get stuck, I'm stuck in my house with a backyard and my family. I'm not stuck in a one-bedroom apartment. And like as you explained, if I need to get a prescription at Walgreens, either I could walk or I could get in my car and go to the drive-in window and get it there.
You know, you mentioned something in passing I want to circle back to, which is just the level to which the city level government has become dominated by a lot of different forces that don't actually have to do directly with the way most people live in the city. And yes. I think particularly of the experience that we've had under Bill de Blasio. Now, I've been going to New York for work for basically a decade, you know, regularly going up there. And then when I started dating my wife before we got married, you know, basically up there every week for almost, you know, 5 years now. And the experience, seeing it in these chunks of time, going from Bloomberg era New York to de Blasio era New York, you see the changes, you see the shifts, you see more homeless, you see more trash on the street, you see just a general decline in the quality of you know, a lot of the different transportation infrastructure and things that people depend on. And de Blasio himself seems like a figure who, you know, was elevated, you know, both by dint of the failure of certain politicians to perform in terms of the ballot box, but also just because he appealed to these various woke critiques of government, for lack of a better term, without offering people the kind of things that they actually need in a mayor, you know, regardless of partisan allegiance. Are we going to at least come out of this with an appreciation for the need for serious executives in charge of cities, and not just people who maybe stoke the more ideological cultural wing of politics?
Well, I have some hope on that level that people will look at this, but you know, I have to say, and I've been a journalist for almost a half century now. I started very young. I find it really scary the way these things have been covered in the media. You know, for instance, I'll give you an illustration. I mean, it's not in this case, it's a governor, not a mayor, but there's been endless positive press for Inslee in Washington. But actually, if you read the South China Morning Post, which I think is a must read for people who follow these things, I think they do the best work of anybody. They basically did a piece saying that they ignored all sorts of warnings when the first cases of the virus came. The state of Washington looked the other way. Just like with de Blasio, he just said, oh, go out and have fun and go to the parades. You know, same things you saw in some mayors in northern Italy did the same thing. The problem is it's so hard in this current media environment to divorce what's really happening from the politics. Now, I'm looking at it from the point of view of, you know, I'm somebody, I don't particularly like Donald Trump. I don't think I could ever vote for him. But I think that I look around and I look at the Democrats and I'm saying, wait a minute, if this was, you know, if this was 1941 and the Japanese were dropping bombs on us, they would be wanting an inquiry about how Roosevelt screwed up, instead of, you know, joining, you know, in the war effort. So, you know, I think some politicians have come out better, but de Blasio has been very ineffective. But the big problem we have, and this is on this issue and lots of other issues, the media now is so slanted and so much essentially a function of the woke progressive movement. And of course, in many cases, the media is now owned by, you know, people out of Silicon Valley who are part of that. It's very hard to get accurate reporting. So I don't know whether there will be a bill to pay. The only hope I have is, you know, that ordinary middle class and working class Americans will see past this crap. Now, the one interesting finding, I was looking at Gallup, they asked all the institutions in the country that were responding to the pandemic, and the lowest ranking, even lower than Congress, was the media.
In fact, my recollection from that Gallup poll is that the media was the only one that was upside down in terms of more on disapproval than approval. And I think one thing that really drives that, Joel, personally, is that typically when you tune into these things, and I realize that a lot of media figures are kind of, they've been engaged for several years now with this kind of performative antagonism of the president, where he'll come out and they'll ask him a tough question and he'll dodge it or he'll get mad at them. And then they have this back and forth where, you know, the media figure is trying to make him look bad and he'll smack the media around, and both sides in that sort of situation tend to benefit from it, you know, I think. But the problem is it's one thing to do that when we're not facing a global pandemic. It's another thing entirely when, well, you know, each one of those questions is actually kind of a big deal and, you know, very important. And the fact that the media has still, even in the course of this, seemed to believe that their relationship with the president is the most important story of the day, that's been a pretty amazing thing for me to watch. And I think of myself as having a pretty low standard when it comes to these media folks.
Well, and I think one of the things that really, like, for instance, you know, and again, I've spent a considerable amount of time in China. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find really astounding is the idea that people will accept the Chinese numbers on, they say
it's infuriating.
Three people died in all of China. And how could that possibly be? Even the Iranians now say that the Chinese numbers are garbage. Mm-hmm. We know that the real roots of this lie in China. Exactly how, I don't know. But we do know that there's been a series of pandemics that have come out of China over the last 20 years. If you go to China and you look at what's going on, you have 250 million migrant workers working in urban areas, living in terrible conditions with no health coverage, and bringing many of the folkways of the Chinese village, where it was probably not a problem, to the urban centers themselves. That's really where a lot of this comes from, and yet the media doesn't report it. And for someone like Hillary Clinton to say, oh, now America's number one, we have the most cases, if anyone really believes that just from the numbers alone that China has far fewer cases than we do, is kind of insane.
Yeah, it really does. It really is infuriating. When the Bloomberg report that came out late last week that was saying, at least according to America's intelligence services, China's lying about their numbers. It's just like, oh, really? You know, did you think otherwise? Come on. I am curious about a couple of things that you expect. You talked about having, you know, spent time in China. This clearly is going to be something that changes the American posture towards China in a lot of different ways. We've heard from, you know, you talk about the old social Democrats. One of the threads that runs through them and that runs through certainly, you know, Donald Trump and a lot of his more nationalist Republican supporters is a belief that we ought to engage in a significant decoupling project, that we ought to bring all sorts of things back front that we have outsourced to China. And I certainly hear that a lot more from people. The basic, you know, thumbnail version of it that I hear from folks is, I don't really care if I'm getting plastic tchotchkes from China. I care if I'm getting drugs from China. And that's the thing that's shifted. How feasible is that? And what do you think ought to be considered in order to achieve that goal?
Well, this is an area where old Democrats like me, no longer a Democrat and independent, but old Democrats like me, people who liked Pat Brown or Harry Truman, or even to some extent Bill Clinton, I think a lot of them are beginning to say, this globalist project, whether it's open borders or in quote free trade, which basically means free trade for them and restricted trade for us, I think that there's now a greater appreciation of this. I think the Democratic Party has its own divisions. Think whatever you want of Bernie Sanders or even Elizabeth Warren on many issues, but on issues like this, issues of trade, issues of really, do we really want, our fighter aircraft to be made with Chinese parts? Mm-hmm. Do we really want, should the Golden Gate Bridge or the Bay Bridge, there was a recent Bay Bridge construction using steel from a Chinese company that had never made a bridge before? Do we really think that this is good? And there's a weird alliance here. You have the left, parts of the left, the authoritarian parts of the left. I was always on the non-authoritarian side, even when I was more on the left. The authoritarians, they love the Chinese model. I mean, you see the articles coming out, oh, China's got the right way. And they, by the way, the same thing on climate change, which anyone who has ever tried to breathe the air in Beijing, maybe this week it's not bad, but I can tell you, I mean, as somebody who lived in Los Angeles for many years of bad smog, we were not competitive in the dirty air business compared to them. But the bottom line is that what we're seeing is that group, but you also have the Bloombergs, a lot of Biden supporters, people who have benefited, Wall Street, people who have benefited from this Chinese relationship. Look, even for someone like me, I don't make steel, I don't assemble cars, I don't build computers. I'm a writer who has made some nice change flying to China and giving speeches. It doesn't hurt me. I know it hurts a lot of my countrymen, and I care enough about them to raise the issue. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that there is at the elite level, and at the on the and parts of the left, there's a confluence of interest. Somebody ought to ask, if I was a shareholder of Apple, I would ask Tim Cook, don't you think it was a little bit a mistake to put all your production in one country?
Yeah.
Don't you a country that clearly wants to own your business over time, that has a history of all sorts of production issues, is a incredibly repressive regime, and you can't even think about diversifying your production? That's pretty scary. Let's face it, at the end of the day, a lot of this linkage to China was very, very profitable for Wall Street. It was very profitable for parts of Silicon Valley. Was it profitable for the middle class and working class of America? I don't think so. So I always have a hard time with this. The in quote progressives think that this model of shifting everything that's dirty out of the country so that we can claim we're clean, they think that's good. But, of course, it's been a disaster for large parts of the middle and working class in this country. The Democratic Party that I came up with was a party that it saw its role as making sure middle and working class Americans had a good shot at the American dream. That is no longer what the left in this country increasingly wants. Much of the left really wants to sort of go back to a almost pre-industrial economy. Doesn't want people to live in houses, wants people to live in apartments, wants people to ride the bus to work, all these things that particularly now they really don't want to do. And I think that the and then there's the group of people at the very top who benefit from this. there's going to be a real interesting picture on the real estate. This is something I'm working on now on real estate. Who's going to invest in high-end residential property in downtown Los Angeles if they're not Chinese?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I was curious about as it relates to dispersal is, we have a situation where the upper middle class and the wealthy Americans have spent, several decades rejuvenating neighborhoods in places like Brooklyn and spent, billions of dollars in that project. Do you think that just gets abandoned? Where does that go? How does that play out?
Well, I think what you're already seeing is the population of Brooklyn is dropping. Mm-hmm. So remember, it had dropped for many years and then came back. The project won't end. The question is, how do we deal with it? I would, and I think both Rich Florida and I have been talking about this. Okay, why don't we create more jobs in Brooklyn so people can walk, bike, drive their car to work without having to get on the subway? Mm-hmm. Maybe we should think about preserving the single family and relatively low density apartments that you have in parts of Brooklyn instead of trying to turn everything into Hudson Yards.
Yeah.
I think that that's, I don't, I think if we humanize and make less stressful life in places like Brooklyn, more people will stay. I also think, it's always interesting to me here, and we see this in California, there is no incentive to work at home. They're actually in the city of Los Angeles, I used to have to pay a big fee to work at home. Now, if I was making porno movies, I would get that. Unfortunately, I wasn't in that business. So the fact is, we can make our cities greener, if you want to use that term, safer, cleaner. We can't do it by shoving more people into the subways and packing them on top of each other. That's not going to work. Again, I think we've hit the peak of the urban resurgence. I think how much it goes back depends on what cities do. What lessons do they draw from this? And unfortunately, as we've been talking about, right now, the political leadership itself is so politically correct and so woke, I think it's going to have a very hard time making these steps. I mean, I think about, I did a lot of work in the, and worked with the government and the civil service of Singapore, many years going there. Now there is a dense city that has done things about as well as you could do it. They still have some issues with the virus, but they're handling it pretty well. But will American cities be willing to have the discipline that Singapore has? You think Lee Kuan Yew would put up with homeless people in the streets? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. So I think that the question is, will city leaders in America begin to say, we have to take the steps that were made in the early 20th century to clean cities up, and what Singapore has done in an impossible situation with no ability to expand geographically, with a hot, humid, pestilence breeding climate. How did they do it? Let's look at what Singapore did, and let's see if there are some lessons that we can learn in urban governance. But what living in a city will be in the 21st century is a lot about discipline, about citizens doing what they're supposed to be doing. My sense of it is that in some parts of America, in some urban centers, people either have a hard time or simply don't follow the rules. If you're going to survive as a city, as was the case in the Renaissance as well, as was the case in Rome, you have to invest in infrastructure, and your citizens have to show discipline. And sometimes you're going to have to do things that are going to offend the woke constituency.
I have been getting emails, people who read my newsletter and who have been reading the things that I've been writing from a number of city officials, people who are working at various levels of governance and in places like Chicago and elsewhere. And I've gotten a couple emails lately from mayors of sort of mid-size or smaller cities who are across the country, particularly in the middle and the Midwest, who are very frustrated with what they're seeing. They have tried to, you know, shut down things in accordance with the wishes of both the pressure from the national press and from you know, their own state officials. But they also are concerned that they are basically dooming their main streets, even if they have, you know, very few cases or no cases in their counties, et cetera. Tell me a little bit about what you think leadership ought to look like in less densely populated areas across the country at this moment.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised that. I did a report for Heartland Forward, which is a new think tank based in Arkansas, actually, in which we're seeing lots of young people moving now to smaller cities and Sunbelt cities, you know, for a somewhat less dense lifestyle, more affordable, more business oriented. And in that report, I got to see many of our smaller city downtowns like Fargo, North Dakota, Springfield, Missouri, that were, and I really understand what you're talking about, because many of these areas were beginning to come back. New Geography is half owned by me and half owned by some friends of mine in North Dakota. So I've been going there many, many years. 30 years ago, 20 years ago, downtown Fargo was awful. It had very few restaurants. It was falling apart. Now downtown Fargo has a wonderful boutique hotel, some really nice restaurants, bars that when you go inside, you think you're at very least in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not, you know, the west side of Manhattan or West LA, but certainly Minneapolis. And these cities were beginning to come back. And I that's a very interesting thing. I'd be very interested in hearing from those mayors, because these small cities were coming back. And there is a really interesting political question. And I raised this in some of the articles that are coming out or have come out. And that is, what do we do at the end of the month when the rate of infection in Springfield, Missouri is 1/100th of mm-hmm. what it is in New York City?
Yeah.
Do we ask Springfield to do penance for what happened in New York? Do we strangle these recoveries in their cribs? These are really, these are very important issues. And I think in this election, if the pattern stays the same, and look, I'm not an epidemiologist, and maybe in the next week, you know, half the people in Arkansas and Missouri will be in the hospital. I don't think that's likely, but it could happen, let's say. But if it doesn't, and we have this vast differences in the levels of infection from one part of the country to the other, from one geography to another, that's going to become an amazing political issue.
Yeah.
I mean, and I even wonder, and, you know, I have some admiration for Governor Cuomo. He's going to have this question. Okay, Governor Cuomo, May 1st, do we start relaxing some of these standards, or do you want to doom New York State to an unbelievable fiscal crisis? Mm-hmm. But there are those in the on the progressive left who actually kind of like this. They like the fact that government can now tell us what we can and cannot do down to the most personal level. Mm-hmm. I actually have a piece coming out in Real Clear, hopefully this week, comparing the reactions of some of the environmental groups who see this as a great thing. Well, now we, you know, if we can strangle commerce, look, we'll have less GHG. Mm-hmm. This is one environmental group called this a test run for the climate emergency that, let's say, President Biden can declare in January of next year.
You know, there's a very haunting video, if you haven't seen it, of from San Francisco, of the deserted streets. You can find it on YouTube. And there's a moment in it in which it hovers. It's clearly taken by drone, in which the drone hovers next to the huge mural of Greta Thunberg looking out over this deserted city. It's one of the most jarring images that I've seen since this whole thing began, because that really is on some level the dream of some of these folks. As we kind of near the end of this interview, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your predictions for the future. There's been a series of pieces by and posts by Tyler Callen and a number of his colleagues, just kind of looking to Russ Roberts as well, looking to the future and trying to anticipate, you know, what we're going to see in terms of changes that are going to take place. One of the things, for instance, that he has in terms of an expectation is that, you know, rather than caring about the walk score, you will care about the speed test, that type of thing. I'm curious what types of predictions you have in mind, particularly ones that maybe I haven't brought up, things that you think could definitely change in a really significant way that we haven't maybe thought about. And while you're thinking perhaps about one, I'll give you one, which is just that I think that we are going to really see a major shift on the educational side of things, and I don't know that it's going to be sort of virtual classes as being a primary thing. I do think that we could probably see an actual uptick in homeschooling or in organized homeschooling, perhaps communal schooling among families and that type of thing. But I just think that there's got to be a shift after this in the way that people view college and the importance of being at a university. And I think that could come sooner than people expect, because there's no real certainty that everybody's headed back in the fall, especially if we have, you know, another uptick. But I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that. I have a piece at the Daily Beast that hopefully will run this week. If not, it'll run on the weekend. So I've had a chance to really think about it, because they asked me the same questions. First of all, I think the most dramatic change will be in how we work. Mm-hmm. Lots of people now are understanding that they really can work at home, at least part-time. Estimates are about 25% of the workforce could work all or part at home. Cannot understand for the life of me, for instance, in our crazy business, what the hell do you need a newsroom for? Mm-hmm. I mean, why don't you have the reporters live in the various areas of your region where they can go out and interview people? Instead of having them, you know, playing office politics. Now, look, you're going to need editors. You're going to need, and you should definitely have the reporters get together for lunch every week, or that's fine. But fundamentally, we're going to see a huge decrease in office space usage. By the way, in my Beast piece, I did the research. This has been going on now for 20 years. We create far less office space per job than we used to. People are going to get used to working at home. As one of the kids said to me the other day, they said, you know, what's the point of driving an hour or taking a train for an hour to go from one computer screen to another?
Yeah.
I mean, you think about how insane it is that we would take people, make them transport themselves, sometimes at their own risk, to go from a computer at home to a computer at an office. It's the boomer and exit control freaks who are going to have a hard time. But my colleague Marshall Toplansky has done a roundtable with CEOs here in Orange County, California, and they're coming back and saying, you know what, this is working great. Mm-hmm. We're not losing anything by doing this. And you know, by the way, maybe I'm going to negotiate a little bit less office space. The second thing is that you're going to see the dispersion of work already taking place. In other words, companies beginning to move their employment from dense urban centers to sub-centers, sometimes in the suburbs, sometimes in less densely populated cities. I think those are happening. I think that when people begin to realize that they can work at home, this is going to be a major change. It's also critical, and this is what I try to tell my friends in the environmental movement. If you have people work at home, this is infinitely more effective than building a train system in Los Angeles for $20 billion that has a smaller share of the commuting population than the buses of 1990 had. Mm-hmm. So why don't we think about these as positives? Also, working at home, which is a big thing for me. My friend, the late Alvin Toffler, said I invented the electronic cottage. Joke, but one of the things that I think is really critical is, what does this mean for families? What does it mean for young mothers in particular? To parents, working at home has given me the opportunity to, if my younger daughter needs me to help her with her AP world history, well, I'm there. I don't have to say, well, you'll have to get me after I've burnt myself out on the 55 freeway and I'm a basket case. Then education, I'm really glad you asked about that, because I've looked into that quite a bit. There was already a growing sense that the educational experience was much too expensive for most people and not particularly productive. I think the idea of of going to a lecture hall like I did when I was at Berkeley with 300 people with a talking head, why can't you do that on Zoom?
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell do you need 300 people packed together? Now, I do think, and we stress this at Chapman, and I'm proud that we do this, the experience of being 25 kids in a room with the professor who wrote the book that they're studying, that's irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. I think that still is a role. But there's got to be much greater use of technology. And then for many people, for kids at school, homeschooling has been growing dramatically already. I think a lot of people are going to start seeing this as an advantage. I think a lot of states are going to start seeing it that, if I can have somebody homeschool and it costs the state $800 a student instead of $20,000 a student, given the budget crises that we're about to see, I think that's going to be a big change. I think it's going to have a big change in globalization. I think Americans are going to start waking up and saying, we have to make our own medicines and our own critical components. So that's going to change too. So I think education, how we work, where we live, I think is going to change. I think the patterns that I've been writing about the last 2-3 years are going to accelerate. And then we're going to have to start thinking about how we build communities in the future. So these are all changes. And by the way, at the end of the day, not necessarily bad. The Spanish flu was a terrible thing. The cities that we built and reformed after the Spanish flu were better. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some upside here too. We really can see this as the window into a very different way of organizing life and community. And that would be a great positive.
Joel, I'll let you go on this. What's one thing that you're doing differently during this time? Culture you're consuming, it's a little bit different for you since you've been working from home all this time, but have you been binging something new on Netflix, listening to a new podcast? What's changed?
Well, I probably check the TV listings and what's on the networks. But, I didn't watch much of it before because most of it was pretty crappy and it's still crappy. So what my wife and I have been doing a bit is watching some of the great old movies that are now available. The other day they had a Kurosawa festival on TCM. So, I'm certainly looking a little bit more. And, of course, as a basketball junkie, I'm still experiencing cold turkey.
Yes, I hear you. I hear you. We all miss that. Joel Kotkin, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. You can follow him on Twitter @Joel Kotkin. Really appreciate you taking the time, sir.
My pleasure.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.